Thank you very much, and let me say how happy I am to see all of you here. This is a wonderful wonderful group of people, and I'm delighted that we're all gathered here together to mark the 100th anniversary of Milton Friedman's birth, and to do so under the auspices of the Becker Friedman Institute for Research in Economics. One of the things that Milton Friedman had remarked at one point is that the, and I'm paraphrasing now, not quoting, is that the true test of a scholar is not what his or her contemporaries think of him or her, but rather how the work looks 25 and 50 years later. Now, there's a lot in that brief statement. We all know that Milton's statements were often very rich in their content, and I think this statement is really quite rich in content as well. It carries what I think are several key messages about what the University of Chicago School of Economics is and what it represents. First, to have work that is recognized 25 and 50 years later means that there are several qualities of it. First, it has to be reflective of fundamental ideas of serious import. So the fact that this has been a school of economics that has focused on major ideas, transforming ideas that changes the way the world thinks, has been one key feature of this entire school of economics at the university. Another feature of work of that stands the test of time is that by virtue of standing the test of time, it has to reflect a great deal of rigor and extreme testing of ideas. And if there, again, is anything that this school is known for, it is the rigor of its inquiry and, shall we say, the vigor with which ideas are tested in this environment. But there's another aspect of this that, to me, is really worthy of thinking about, and that is the statement about contemporaries. Because one of the things that we've seen with many of the ideas that have come out of the Chicago School of Economics is, in fact, shall we say, a lack of appreciation by contemporaries. And I think it's a good moment to take stock of how much emotional fortitude this takes. It is not a simple thing to be dealing with ideas that you believe in, and to be dealing with what is often a great deal of resistance because they change the prevailing paradigms. So to me, this particular feature of it not being for the faint of heart, of having the emotional fortitude to go through this, makes this Chicago School of Economics have a history which is not only an intellectual history, not only a history of impact, but actually a deeply human story. And so I want to express my appreciation, because I actually view many of what's happened here at Chicago not just as the work of brilliant people who have done outstanding work of impact, but actually of heroes who have withstood a huge amount of personal difficulty and intellectual challenge, and sometimes more than intellectual challenge, in order to achieve what they have. There are many people in this room, economists in this room, who are here, some who should still be here, but who aren't. And I want to say to all of them in particular how much I appreciate what this group has done and the meaning of that work, not only from the point of view of impact on the world, not only from the point of view of impact on scholarship, but because it really reflects a deep degree of emotional power and emotional fortitude. Now, the Becker Friedman Institute that is sponsoring this event is an ambitious undertaking by the university. We want it to be the premier intellectual destination for thought in economics and its connection to business law, policy, and beyond, and that it should reflect the same degree of fierce independence, rigor, and impact that the School of Economics has represented all along. It's off to a very good start. It's obviously a startup. There's a lot more to do. And I particularly want to thank the many people in this room who have supported this initiative. It started out really as an idea without a huge amount of history as a startup, and many people in this room have stepped up because of their belief in the Chicago School of Economics, its connection to business, its connection to law, its connection to policy, what it's meant for the world, have stepped up and supported this in a very substantial and dramatic way. So I want to thank everybody here who has done that, together with the degree of power of the economists at the University of Chicago, whether in particularly in the economics department or those in the Booth School and beyond. That group combined with the commitment that those of you who have supported and I hope will continue to support the Becker-Friedman Institute together will ensure the power and the future of the Chicago School of Economics going forward. So to all of you, thank you very much. And again, let me add my welcome to, I know, the many that you received earlier today. So thanks very much.
So I'm Lars Hansen. I have the honor to introduce tonight's mid-dinner speaker, Gary Becker. Before doing so, though, I would like to thank Sunil Kumar and the Booth School for hosting this very special event. We truly appreciate this. Of course, tonight's speaker really needs no introduction, as he is one of the absolute best economists over the last several decades. And he's been an intellectual pillar at the university during much of his time, and I've certainly had the honor to be one of his colleagues for several years now. There's little reason to review Gary's vast collection of honors. It is vast, but I will take this occasion to remind you that he won the prestigious Nobel Prize in Economics and the National Medal of Science. As a former student, a colleague, and a good friend of Milton Friedman, Gary is the best person to give us a perspective on Friedman's intellectual legacy. We are very lucky to have one great economist tell us about another one. Gary?
Thank you, Lars. It's a great pleasure to be here and to honor Milton and to follow two great panels that we had this afternoon where the points made were deep, penetrating, and really got to the essence of a lot of his scientific contributions. Now, I knew Milton Friedman ever since I entered the University of Chicago as a very young graduate student. He was my teacher, later my colleague, and a close friend. I enormously admired him for his research, but not only for his research, for his intellect, his character, his courage, his sunny optimism. Somebody said to me today, well, you're an optimist. I said, I am, but not nearly as much as Milton Friedman was. He had sunny optimism, and he had many other positive traits. I could speak for hours about him, but I would be booed after a while if I kept going. So I'm going to try to, I have limited time, I'm going to try to stay within the boundaries. If I go over those boundaries, I'll take some of Jim Heckman's time for a future speech. My remarks start with Milton Friedman as a person, and then I'll go into some of his more direct public policy contributions that weren't covered today. He was an outstanding teacher. Kevin Murphy went over some of his attractive attributes. I'm going to expand on that a little bit. Because I had him when I first came, my first class I went to was Milton Friedman's class. And I was amazed at the class. Turns out he put me down very correctly and severely in that first day, but that was fine. I learned a good lesson from that. Keep your mouth shut until you have something positive to say. He developed theory clearly. So he was not just an empiricist. He believed strongly in theory. That point was brought out today. And he showed applications with numerous real-world examples. He didn't go into a lot of quantitative data, but he knew the world. And he showed, look, the theory is relevant here. We can explain this. We may ask him questions. He said, well, that's a puzzle. We have to think about that more. So it was what another teacher of mine said, Ted Schultz, it was a dialogue between theory and evidence. And Milton Friedman was par excellence, the master of that kind of dialogue. For him, theory was an engine of analysis. He got that language from one of his economists he admires most, Alfred Marshall. And it was a way of analyzing the real world. And it showed not how clever the theorist was. That was not his goal. He didn't think that was the goal of economics. The goal of theory was to show how relevant the theory was in explaining the world. And if it wasn't relevant, how do we change the theory to make the explanations even better? My first job was teaching at the University of Chicago when I was very young. I was assistant professor, and half my time I was supposed to devote to assisting Milton Friedman. That was a great, great thing. I mean, no better way of learning and being with a master. We went down, I remember one day Milton said, well, we have to pick up 6 used Marsh ants. These were old calculating machines. Now used, Milton Friedman didn't throw money around. These were used. So we went downtown, we picked up these Marsh ants, we brought them back, and there was a room in the basement of the old social science building where about 10 graduate students crowded together who had access to these Marsh ants. And I participated very regularly. I helped run, in a minor way, the money and banking workshop. So people don't think of me as a money and banking person, but that was what I did in the early part of my career. And to watch Milton as a teacher in the money and banking workshop, he was a teacher. Somebody would come in, a student or somebody from the outside, go over the paper. Milton almost invariably would find some things wrong with the paper, but he wouldn't stop there. He would show them how to improve what they were doing. I mean, that's a great thing. It's relatively easy to see flaws in what people are doing. It's much harder to see the flaws and show them how you might correct these flaws. He was a master at doing that. Now, I like to say Milton was a truth missionary. Truth was his holy grail. He smiled a lot when people presented bad ideas, so it was hard to dislike him. He kept smiling, but he kept showing you how wrong it was what you were saying. I mean, I remember being with him in a taxi cab. The cab driver said some offhand remark about economics, and Milton Friedman had the cab stop, the meter running, and he devoted his time to showing the cab driver why he was wrong. And he did that. I mean, he did that with everyone. He would not compromise on the truth. And it hurt him sometimes. It hurt his career. Let me give you an example. Jim Hackman mentioned today a great book that Milton wrote, not very well known. He wrote jointly with Simon Cousins, but the important parts were by Milton Friedman. It's called Income from Independent Professional Practices. Now, that was written for the National Bureau of Economic Research. And in those days, I don't know what the procedure is today, every book that was to be published by the National Bureau had to be approved by all the members of the board of directors. There was one member who refused to approve the book. Why? Because in that book, Milton had argued, I think correctly, that the AMA, the American Medical Association, which, and doctors were one of the professions that he studied, had a monopoly. They were restricting entry by, let's say, not giving immigrants, this was in the 30s, not giving immigrants who wanted to come, immigrant doctors. They were restricting their access to the United States, restricting the ability to open medical schools. So he proved, to his satisfaction at least, that they were a monopoly. The director just couldn't abide that conclusion. And so it took 2 to 3 years before the book was ever published. And they finally worked out a compromise. And what was that compromise? Milton and Simon Cousins could go ahead and say the AMA was a monopoly, but appended to that book was an article by the director arguing against their position. It was a terrible article. You look at it in retrospect, it was a terrible piece of work. But Milton wouldn't budge, the director wouldn't budge, so they finally got this compromise. And anyone, go look at that book. You'll see at the end of it, you say, what's this article doing by, I forgot the name of the director. That's the reason it was there. Milton was also very brave. It's not an easy quality to have in any activity, any field, and certainly in intellectual activities, because the bulk of a profession is set on their ideas. Now, that's not a bad reason. Ideas have been developed, you absorb them, you learn them. You don't want to give up these ideas very readily. I mean, in technical language, you made a lot of specific capital investments in these ideas, and so you shouldn't give them up very readily. But Milton challenged a lot of ideas, and he suffered a lot of heat for it. He challenged Keynesian economics, as was mentioned today. He challenged ideas about exchange rates. He challenged the Social Security system. He challenged the sort of general view that free markets, they had to be really decisively regulated, that maybe central planning and socialism was much, much better. He suggests we have a flat tax system rather than a highly progressive system, and so on. So he was extremely unpopular. I don't know if he cared. I think sometimes it hurt him because the attacks got very personal. And maybe he even liked the battles. But he would take these stands because he believed in these stands. And he felt if he had to be unpopular, so be it. He'll take the heat. And he took an enormous amount of heat that one can hardly appreciate today, given the worldwide celebration of his 100th year of his birth, how unpopular and how vicious the attacks were made on him. And I have one example of his attitude. In 1964, I was a professor at Columbia, and we were fortunate to have Milton Friedman spend the year visiting us at Columbia. Now that was during the Goldwater campaign, and Milton Friedman was the primary economic advisor to Barry Goldwater. And you know, Barry Goldwater was a conservative, and people were saying he needed a psychiatrist and so on, and any person who advised him, they felt needed two psychiatrists to help him get it. But Milton Friedman was his chief advisor. This was in New York City. And at least once a week, he would go out and debate some other New York intellectual. So one day I said to Milton, Milton, don't you find it difficult going out and debating where everybody's going to be against you? And I remember his answer. I can't quote it verbatim, but I think I'll be pretty close. He said, no, it's easy. These New Yorkers are so insular. They've never heard a good argument on the other side. So instead of being difficult, it's very easy. And I'm sure, I didn't go to any of the debates, but I'm sure if you had an objective moderator, he won those debates hand on. Now that comes to debate. He was a great debater. Now there are different ways to debate. You can make wise alecky remarks about your opponent, attack them personally, call them liars. We see that in some of the literature, some of the press by economists and others who have no reluctance in calling somebody else a liar. Milton Friedman never did that. He debated people how? And somebody mentioned that in one of the panels today. He, first of all, he understood their argument better than they did. So he restated the argument. And then he showed why it was flawed. That was his debating technique. No tricks, no personal attacks, just knowing the issues better, presenting the opponent's argument better than they could present it, and then attacking. I remember I was in a seminar when I was working for him in the money and banking workshop. A famous economist from Harvard came, Alvin Hansen, and he was presenting views. He was a very popularizer of Keynes, very well known at the time. And at one point, Milton Friedman said, "Let me summarize your views." And he went on and on. He said a few things. And he said, "Is that an accurate summary?" And Hansen, who wasn't that smart, actually, said, "Yeah, that's an accurate summary." Now, Milton Friedman said, "Let me show you why they're completely wrong." And I mean, he had a great skill. So I say it wasn't debating techniques. I'd like to say a word about Rose, because Rose was tremendously important to Milton. She was, of course, his longtime love. That was the only way to describe it, his longtime love. His intellectual companion. His support when times were difficult. His critic at many times. And Gidi and I saw that because for about 15 years, we went to a weekend hosted by George Shultz with about five or six couples. And we drove down together, the Friedmans and us, and I drove Milton's car because I'm not a great driver, but Milton was a lot worse, let me say. So I figured we were minimizing our risk by my doing it rather than his doing it. And during the course of this drive, all of us participated in the conversation, so much so that we usually missed a turnoff, and Rose would say, "Hey, we missed that turnoff 10 miles back there, and we had to go back." And Rose was active, as was Gidi, in the discussion. Both of them were discussing along with Milton, and Milton listened to all views, mine, theirs, everybody's. Of course, he was the leader of the group, and they were very intense. And one thing I remember about Rose from that occasion and others, she was not afraid to correct Milton when she thought he was wrong. If he deviated from he thought he was making too many concessions to the opponents to free market, she would say, "Milton, you're wrong on that. They haven't thought that through," and many other ways. So she had an important mind in her own right. She was a co-author with him on a number of books, and she was absolutely, I think, essential to Milton. Milton was a genius, there's no doubt about it, but Rose's support was of enormous importance. I don't think any discussion of Milton's anniversary can go by without mentioning the importance of Rose in his life. Now let me make a shift now to Milton's role in public policy analysis. And I think it's important on this anniversary because this birthday has been celebrated throughout the world. There was an important celebration this summer in Chicago that Leo helped organize and spoke at, which unfortunately I couldn't make, Leo. There was celebrations in London, in Asia, all over the world. Now, why were these celebrations? Most of the people doing these celebrations knew Milton Friedman mainly from his public policy views. That's where he was mainly known. We in economics know him for his consumption function that Bob mentioned and many others, great scientific contributions. But in the world at large, he was known mainly for his public policy views. So I'd like to discuss a few examples of these drawn from Capitalism and Freedom. Now, it's an old book. In fact, this year is the 50th anniversary of the publication of that book. It's the 100th anniversary of Milton's birth. It turns out to be a 50th anniversary of the publication of one of his greatest public policy book, by far. I'm going to take four examples, although my time may run out before I get to all those examples, so let me start. I mean, one can't start without vouchers. That was his love. Eventually, he and Roe started a foundation for the promotion of vouchers. He wrote an article in the 50s, a long time ago, and it took a long time for the ideas about vouchers to permeate at all. Still, it's been hard to get them passed politically. Now, what was Milton's basic idea? His basic idea was competition is valuable in every industry. And one of the big problems in education was we do not have enough competition. And vouchers, in his view, and I think the correct view, was a way of bringing in more competition, which would mean more innovation, greater progress in the quality of schools. It would not only be the schools that people on vouchers were attending, it would also improve the quality of the public schools that where students were attending who weren't on vouchers. It goes both ways. That was his argument. And it's a very detailed argument. He discusses a lot of the issues and so on. Now, unfortunately, vouchers have never been widely adopted in the United States. They've always been very strongly opposed by teachers' unions and by other groups. What did get established were charter schools, which is a way of bringing in competition. Milton was not a great fan of charter schools, but they have been a way of bringing in important competition, and vouchers for the poor, which has started in a number of places. Milton was also opposed to vouchers for the poor alone. He said vouchers for the poor would be a poor program. I think he was wrong on that one, and I also think he should have supported charter schools because not as good as vouchers, but an important step in the right direction. My next example is exchange rates. And here I have something personal to say. When I was an undergraduate, Milton came to lecture at Princeton, and he lectured on flexible exchange rates. And I listened to him, and I said, gee, he's not impressive. This stuff is too easy. I mean, it seemed too easy. Now, Milton was a master at using easy, so-called easy economic analysis to discuss important problems. Now, I was too young and stupid to appreciate that at the time. I've learned to appreciate that much more later on. And what did he do in flexible exchange? Well, flexible exchange rates were out of fashion then. We had Bretton Woods and fixed rates. Partly because people have claimed they had shown that flexible exchange rates were inherently unstable and couldn't work. So Milton Friedman went and looked at the evidence and showed how flawed the evidence was opposed to flexible exchange rates, and then brought in theory to argue why flexible exchange rates would work very well and why they would be valuable in helping countries adjust the balance of payments problems and the like. That's what he argued. So he had data and theory, as we heard this afternoon, interacting to lead to his positions. Well, as we know, flexible exchange rates have spread in much of the world, and we went off the fixed gold standard and fixed rate in the early 70s, and Milton was very proud of that achievement. He was very much opposed to the euro before it was started, and I think he was opposed for the right reason. He claimed that there would only be individual countries suffering from idiosyncratic risk and a fixed rate would not enable them to make as easy an adjustment to the shocks they were opposed to as would flexible rates. Well, we now have the problems with Greece and Spain and so on. And Milton, again, against great opposition, I think turned out to be absolutely correct on that. Milton was, and again, it was all in Capitalism and Freedom. He offered, to my knowledge, the first intellectual case for privatizing Social Security and having individual accounts. He lays out in great detail the problems with the pay-as-you-go system and the advantages of having an individual account system where people would save, they'd accumulate this, and in retirement they would have resources they could spend. He's against compulsory. He felt people would do it on their own. He believed there would be competition for the investments and so on. Very, very subtle and a deep discussion. And it took, as usual, with important ideas, and people have stressed that today, but I want to reiterate that. Somebody comes along with a major idea like vouchers, flexible exchange rates, privatized Social Security. You know, the world isn't ready for this idea, and it automatically gets accepted because you show that it works. It takes time. It takes events. It usually takes crises to provide the conditions for which new ideas can be introduced. And that happens in my two earlier examples on vouchers or charter schools. It happened certainly with flexible exchange rate, and happens with Social Security. Chile was the first country to move to a privatized system, and now there are many countries who have a privatized system. U.S. has lagged behind Great Britain, Sweden, and a number of other countries in moving at least to a partially privatized system. My last example is the very first chapter of Capitalism and Freedom, the relationship between economic and political freedom. When I was a first-year graduate student living in a dormitory, Milton came to deliver that chapter to our dorm group. So we all gathered around in a small room, and he gave this idea, and it really blew my mind. I mean, it was a brilliant discussion, something I never thought about before. And we got into a lot of arguments, and I remember asking some questions, other people asking questions. Milton was in a relaxed framework. He was handling very well. And then it comes out as the first chapter of this book. What is his argument? Well, his argument, and you know, it's controversial. He felt that political freedom was necessary for economic freedom. Without political freedom, you wouldn't have economic freedom. On the other hand, he didn't think economic freedom was sufficient to guarantee you're going to have political freedom. Now, that's relevant today. Take a country like China. It's moved not toward the degree of markets that Milton would like, or I would like, or most of us here would like, but it's moved substantially from, let's say, the late 70s to the present toward a market-oriented system. It still has a big presence of state-owned enterprises, but still it's moved that way. The question is, will that movement toward economic freedom, imperfect as it is, put pressure to create political freedom in China? There certainly is a lot more freedom in China than I first visited China in 1981, and there's no comparison today and then. But still, there's no political freedom. There's a single party and the like. I don't know the answer to that question. I'm an optimist like Milton, as I said. I believe ultimately you'll have competitive elections in China, that economic freedom, as it did in South Korea and in Taiwan and a number of other places, not everywhere, but many places, will force political freedom. We'll see about that. But he was very early on in thinking about the interaction between the two, because freedom in all spheres of life was really important to Milton. Now, before I conclude, let me stress one thing. When Milton came to analyzing public policies, he says it explicitly in Capitalism and Freedom. I heard him say it many times. The main differences between people, economists and others, on the whole, is not their values, but is in their analysis of how actual policies will work themselves out. So for example, if we raise the taxes on higher income people, how much disincentive effects will they have? That's a big issue that good economists differ on. I have one view. John Taylor will probably have a similar view, but you know, there'll be other people with other views, and I can't say that the evidence is conclusive that is the correct view. Milton always felt that we had to do the research, because by doing the research, we don't have to worry about the difference in values. People have the same values, so if we could persuade people that various policies would lead in this direction, that the theory would lead in this direction, we then have a chance of having an effect on policy. Not immediately, and with age, he felt it became more distant. It took a while to get public policy to be changed. I think it was greatly influenced by George Stigler in this respect. But eventually, we would have the effect. Now, if people are differing in basic values, then it's kind of hopeless How are you going to get, I mean, you can have a democracy and 51% would go one way and 49% the other way, but it's a difference in basic values. I mean, he's just going to have this perennial conflict. So that's his optimism. It's not the values. It's the differences in judgments about the real world and what effects do. And I think that was part of his DNA, so to speak. So let me conclude. I probably run over my time already, but Jim, you set a good example in that regard. I'll take a little extra time, okay? Milton Friedman, to sum up, was a great teacher, an outstanding person, a major contributor to modern economics, an ingenious inventor of effective approaches to social policies, economic policies, which is I've been talking about, and he had a remarkable marriage over many decades with his beloved Rose. So there's no wonder we and others have been celebrating the 100th anniversary of his birth. On a personal note, he was my standard for over 50 years that I knew him. If I said or wrote something he liked, it greatly pleased me, as Gidi well knows. If he criticized something I wrote or said, I thought, uh-oh, I must have made a mistake. And almost always, I did make a mistake. Even after he passed away, I think in my mind, what would Milton Friedman think of this argument or view? Certainly, he radically changed my life forever from the first time I stepped into his price theory class. And I spent 6 years studying at his feet, basically, first as a graduate student, then as an assistant professor. In later years, I said, Gidi and I spent time with him as friends and Rose. We had both personal and intellectual discussion. Chicago appointed Milton when he was 34 years old, a great appointment for Chicago. We appointed him, although I wasn't part of the appointment process, before the profession as a whole knew about his greatness. And that's, I think, the goal of the Department of Economics, the business school, the law school, all the other groups associated with the BFI, and our goal at the Institute. If we can occasionally make an appointment of a promising young person who comes close to being another Milton Friedman, we have made a great achievement. Thank you very much. No. In the tradition of Chicago, I'm supposed to say we have some Q&A now. So, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Anybody have any questions about anything I said or any other issues? Okay, John. I'll repeat it when he finishes. Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. Let me repeat the question because a lot of people couldn't hear you, John. The question was, well, yes, Milton had the view that, you know, when we get better evidence and so on, that'll bring people together. Has it really happened? I think that's the question. I think it has happened, and I'll say the sense in which it has happened. We've seen a lot of public policies introduced when we had enough agreement among many people in the profession and the times were right to introduce the policy. Take the deregulation movement of the 70s and so on. That didn't come out of nowhere. That came because the cartel of the New York Stock Exchange was causing a lot of damage. The cartel of the airlines was causing a lot of damage. The cartel of the trucking was causing a lot of damage. And there was increasing research in economics demonstrating that. So research, once it demonstrates something, doesn't automatically lead to public policy. Public policy is a result of a lot of interest groups. But research combined with the right time in events leads to it. So I think there are a lot of examples. Now, there are also a lot of examples where we've come, maybe we have come together, we haven't come together, and we haven't gotten to public policies. Now, sometimes we don't come together because maybe the evidence isn't speaking so clearly. And sometimes we don't get the public policy because, well, the evidence is speaking clearly, but you're opposing a lot of interest groups. So take the teachers' unions. They're a powerful interest group. Everybody pretty much recognizes, and a lot of empirical studies now suggesting that you have competition, you have charter schools, you have vouchers, children do better. Children do better. So there's not 100% agreement, but there's a lot of agreement on that. But you have to overcome the power of this union. Now, it's gradually being overcome because we're seeing, as Jim has shown in a number of his papers, the stability of the dropout rate in the United States between 25 and 30% is highly depressing, and people are becoming aware of that. So I think we'll eventually come there, but we're not there yet. So my view is, yes, it works, but sometimes the evidence isn't so clear, and sometimes we're not ready politically to do it yet. And you need some event to make the political system ready to look for ideas that maybe will have an influence. Anything else? Okay, thank you.